Haven't heard of you before.
It's the unknown. Unknown. It's the unknown. Unknown preacher.
Beautiful people, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Unknown Preacher LA. I'm your host, the Unknown Preacher, aka LA, aka Lonzo. And with me this morning, Josh and Kaya. How are you?
We're doing good.
Doing pretty good. Appreciate it.
Good, good. Good to hear from ya. It's been a minute. Yeah. Hey, so I'm excited, y'all, because, yes. Again, it has been a minute, but what have y'all been up to?
Traveling.
Traveling. Yeah, Kaya, congrats on successfully completing your training. And if flight attendant, is that the proper?
Yes, that's the proper okay, term. Cool. Just not stewardess or air hostess.
Man, because what did they used to call back in the day? I forgot.
Stewardesses.
Stewardesses, yes, 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 yes. Mm-hmm. Man, congratulations. We are so proud of you.
Thank you.
Definitely.
Yeah, we need people with your, what do I want to say, customer service skill set in those positions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey, do you have a crazy passenger story? Or yes. Are you allowed? Are you?
No, I can talk about it. I got a lot.
Uh-oh, I got to hear one. Tell us one good.
Basically, it's not really a passenger. It's more so like they're another like person, like work, like a captain.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he was... we have this thing called jump seating, so he can sit in the back with us while we do work. So if he needs to get to where he needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept smelling a horrible smell in the back of the plane. I went up in the aisle, came back, and I'm like, what is that smell? What is that smell? And I kept smelling it throughout the whole flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we had heavy turbulence, so I was like, maybe that shook something up and he can't go to the bathroom. And he's probably embarrassed, so I'm gonna give him that.
Yeah,
because I realized that it was him who was expelling the smell.
Yeah.
And at the end of the flight, we're making casual conversation because he can't get his bag yet because the people are deplaning.
Mm-hmm.
And in the midst of this conversation, he leans over and farts.
Mm.
Like, and I was so caught off guard. I couldn't say anything except stare at him because I was like, did I hallucinate that? Like, did he actually do that in front of me? And then the second time he leans over and he farts again.
What?
And I said, this guy's doing it on purpose. So I ended up just not, I just stared at him. I couldn't even.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's one of those stories. Now, and I guess, what do you report? I was just going to say, could you report that? I don't know if you have a policy on.
Oh, no, I can't report it. It was just him. Mm. He was just being rude.
People are crazy.
He was just being rude.
People did, well, some. That's out there, man.
Yeah. Hey,
yeah, and I'll tell y'all this. I haven't told many, but I haven't flown since COVID.
Really?
Yeah, I purchased some tickets twice. I was supposed mm-hmm. to go to Atlanta one time and Dallas the other, and just didn't. I ended up, things beyond my control, I had to cancel both times.
Yeah.
So, but I was going to, but I'm just, mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems like it's been crazy since COVID. I don't know if Josh, if either one of y'all can say how it looked before COVID versus how flying looks now and how different it is. I don't know how y'all feel about that.
Well, I would say, and I appreciate you, sharing that question. I would say,
you know, before COVID, I used to go on a lot of trips with my family. Uh-huh. And, you know, COVID disrupted that flow now. So, yeah. You know, now we go here and there. We're always, you know, being very protected with one another. And, you know, it's just COVID definitely was an obstacle, but I'm mm-hmm. glad we got through it. We were able to manage it and see it through. And I know, like, also, like, some of the flights and things, like, in certain countries, I heard that, like, the prices are reduced, or, the flights are reduced because of, like, COVID and all these, you know, natural disasters that are happening in the world now today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a big change, too. I mean, like, it's more so I feel like we've lost etiquette mm-hmm. and empathy with each other. I mean, like... Mm-hmm. COVID made a lot of, I feel like, with mental health.
Yeah.
That's so important because people were alone with their thoughts now. It wasn't so busy. And so when you come out, you forget how to interact with people.
Yes.
So, like, I had my fair share of, like, just rude people or people who don't understand or just treat you differently. And I mean, like, because I've seen it, because I used to fly a lot before, too, with mm-hmm. my mom. She's a flight attendant as well. So I've seen, like, both sides of, like, just coming back. Because my mom, she went through it. So she told me stories. She didn't have as many bad stories as she did as she does now after COVID. So it's been a lot. All I can say is make sure you got your real ID. And keep it trucking, because real ID, they've been turning a lot of people away.
Really?
So, yes, and it's ruining a lot of people's travel plans and stuff. Just make sure you got that gold star, whatever it is for your state. I think it's a gold star for everybody.
It is.
Yeah.
And they've been making, like, enough. I thought that they communicated that enough, even though I think the DMVs have been overwhelmed. But I do know that they made it clear. You're not boarding a plane without it. So.
Yep. It's been in progress for... I think they've been saying it for the past 5 years or
at
six,
least,
7 years.
Maybe longer. Ten, I think seven. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, I will be flying eventually. I just, you know, when the right event, the right opportunity comes, we'll more to come on that. But mm-hmm. I'm just proud of you for graduating and doing your thing. Kudos to Josh too for holding me down. You know, one thing about relationships, when you have that person who's what do I want to say, your biggest cheerleader, right? You have a good thing. And so I'll just share this. Josh called me all excited about your graduation, and it was such a big deal for him, you know.
He did.
And I'm like, that's my nephew right there. That's what I'm talking about. And you know, God designed, like, and I'm gonna say marriage to be a relationship of support and companionship, and the Bible talks about it, you know, like two are better than one. What does it say? If either falls down, one can help the other, something to that effect. All I ask is to be the one to marry y'all when that day comes. I told Josh, it's been about 3 years now. That's about the average time now.
3 years.
No
three
pressure. Years.
It's coming. It's coming.
It's coming. Okay.
Yeah.
It's coming.
It's going to surprise you.
It's going to surprise me.
See, I'm not going to do like the ordinary people, you know. I'm going to do something that's going to like shock you. You know?
All I ask is that you make me get my nails done beforehand. Make sure I don't look a hot mess.
Take pictures.
Yeah, make sure I don't look a hot mess. That's all I ask.
I got you. We're going to figure it out together. Yeah.
I love it. Now, keep in mind, now I can marry y'all now. So
that's fact. That'd be great. Because you know us.
I propose live and all of that on the show, but. I'm not going to steal your thunder, Josh. Hey,
no, I'll say this, you know, I'll let you know beforehand, you know, and I definitely think, you know, it would be great to put it on the show. You might get some views.
Man. Goodness. You
might get some views.
That's what I'm talking about. Y'all are so good together, man. So, yeah. You know, that support reminds me of this series on... I saw on Netflix called Forever, and it's about a couple who fall in love during their junior year in high school, and you know, they're young and make mistakes, but through all of it, they were like there for one another, and especially at times when they both really needed that support and encouragement. And so
that's
what I'm talking about, man.
Yes, definitely. We gotta stay strong for one another, you know, especially during these times.
Well,
so for everybody, you know, we're here to support, love, and help each other. So
yes. Josh, I haven't seen Kai smile this big, man, ever.
She's been home for 4 days. That's what it is.
Yeah, I haven't been home so much.
That's what I'm
relaxed.
I love it.
But how's everything going with you, Unc, though? I didn't mean to cut you off, but any plans?
Lovely, man. God is good all the time, man. I mean, I'm just... I'm happy for the connections, the people that I get to meet and interview, and then for people like you and Kaya and my other co-hosts on rotation. Like I lean on y'all all the time. Y'all make this look easy, man. So just really appreciate it.
Definitely. We appreciate you too.
Yeah. Now I know y'all are super busy and y'all have to celebrate and do your thing before Kaya leaves again. So before we close out, any final words, any thoughts?
No. I mean, nothing on my end. What about you?
I just say continue to be safe and
and
pray and have faith in God, and also just be kind to one another. This job that I have now has taught me that to look at people in other jobs, not like people are not, I mean, I never looked at people below me as below me, but we can come complacent and not understanding people's story or understanding what they have going on in life. So just be kind to one another. Try to do a nice thing or compliment somebody, or even if you're going to go to Chick-fil-A and they forget something in your order, just be nice about it. Speaking from experience today, or just, I don't know, just try to do something kind.
Man, I love that, Kaya. I can't even top it, man. I'll just add that God really shines on those relationships. And I'm going to circle back on you two. Y'all two are something kind of special. So y'all just keep being good to each other and doing what you do. And the best thing I can say is, don't change up. However you start it, just keep doing what you're doing, man.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
But I love y'all, man. And
man,
we gotta do it again. Safe travels, Kaya. We appreciate you. We're proud of you. Josh, nephew, you know how I feel, man. So y'all be in touch soon.
Okay.
Be in touch soon, of course.
All right.
I might have to do this for the camera.
Oh,
that you just made me do it. You didn't want me to do it. Okay, there you go.
There we go.
It's gonna be see us though.
It's gonna be much more. It's recording.
They heard.
It's recording. Huh?
They didn't hear that.
We'll make certain this video is on the social media. We will ensure
she's
that.
I'm a little nervous.
I be getting nervous.
But it's all good.
I love him.
She's an actress.
I love him, but I be getting nervous.
You're an actress.
Everyone's different with that. Some people don't have a hard time with public affection, and some don't. So, yeah.
I don't mean to embarrass you. I'm sorry, baby. I love you.
I love you too.
Oh.
All right.
Y'all have a good one. Much love, y'all.
Much love.
Bye. Listen, listen, listen. You have to get a taste of Treats of the Realm, man. Two sisters who love making treats for special occasions, or if you just want to treat yourself. Hey, listen, you can find them on Facebook. You can find them on IG. Or you can email them at treatsoftherealm@gmail.com or give them a call, 910-322-3667. Treats of the Realm. Beautiful people, we are back, and I should have noted this earlier, but this is the 100th episode. Praise God, praise God, and I appreciate all the support. So our guest this morning, we have two, and their stories are a little different, but there is overlap. First, we have the founder and CEO of Greater Ascension Community and Economic Development Incorporated, and she was educated as a rocket scientist, afforded the opportunity to work for NASA, but followed her passion of servitude and worked in the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change in Atlanta, GA. And she's been honored by the governor's office in Georgia. She was also a consultant with Atlanta Housing Authority. And now her mission, her purpose, is giving direction to young people by uplifting them and assisting them in overcoming obstacles. Please welcome to the Unknown Preacher LA, Tiffany Swope. How are you, Tiffany?
I am well. I am honestly blessed, and it is truly an honor to be here. So thank you for inviting me tonight. Excuse me, this morning.
No, thank you. You're good people, man. I appreciate you. And yeah, I had to do my own little research, but it was easy to pull all that wonderful and impressive resume. So I'm honored to have you on. So, and our second guest is a professor of psychology at North Carolina Central University. Go Eagles. And that's their psychology department. He received his MS from Florida A&M with a focus on African and African-American psychology. His areas of interest are African-American psychological well-being and the cumulative effects of racism and social inequalities on African-American youth, mental health, and health disparities. Additional areas of interest include program evaluation, community development, and education reform. His current research focuses on social and psychological factors associated with positive mental health outcomes. He has served as co-director for the Institute for Children, Youth, and Families, and was also the director of outreach for the Export Grant, a project of the Julius Chambers Biomedical Biotechnical Research Institute at NCCU. And more recently, he has served as co-project director on a partnership project with Duke that is evaluating the effectiveness of efforts to reduce health disparities and to educate the African-American community about COVID-19, alcohol, and substance abuse, cervical cancer, and cardiovascular disease risk factors. And he and I are part of EQRX. More to come about that too. Please welcome to the Unknown Preacher LA, Dr. Jonathan Livingston. How are you, my brother?
Doing well. Glad to be here. Glad to be a part of this effort.
Man, with all the pedigrees in here, man, you too. I'm honored. I don't even think, without hesitation, I can say it's great to be amongst friends. So I appreciate both of you. And I was telling you two a little before we hit record. And if you listen to last week's episode, we had gospel sensation Sonya Griffin on. She talked about her, people approaching her who were contemplating suicide, and they heard her song and then changed that ideation. So this is going to be a really necessary discussion, I think. But I wanted to start with you, Tiffany, a little bit. You're a woman of many talents. You majored in physics and mathematics. And just hearing that is a little intimidating, by the way. But I applaud you. Very impressive. So tell our listeners where you're from, and tell us your story.
So I am in Durham, North Carolina, by way of Atlanta, Georgia, but my home is Decatur, Alabama. I graduated or spent most of my life around Decatur, Alabama, and upon graduating with my degree in physics, I left Alabama 3 weeks later to sleep on someone's couch and start a new life in Atlanta. And I would just like to stop there and say, God is a very faithful God. That move in that moment was actually an answered prayer that I quietly spoke as my mother and I took a road trip through Atlanta going to Macon, Georgia. And that trip was less than 6 months before the shift came. Once I arrived in Atlanta, I ended up working at the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Justice Change. My former director of grants administration, which I actually was an intern in during my time at Calhoun Community College, she and I, we had a great working relationship. She really inspired me. She was one of the sharpest, most professional young Black women that I had actually encountered at that time. And vice versa, I left my imprint on her. And when her career led her forward, she actually called me out of the blue and said, "Tiffany, I have a temporary job. Would you be willing to come here for 6 weeks?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" And she said, "Make me one promise. You'll go back to Alabama and work in your field of study." I said, "Okay, I'll consider it." She didn't know that I had no plans of coming back home. And she didn't know that God had given me a yes. So that opportunity ended up really changing my life in many ways. That 6 week opportunity turned into about 7.5 years in Atlanta. And it was an amazing experience that really changed my life in so many ways.
Wow. Wow. That's deep. I know that, and thank you for sharing that. I know you gave me a compelling story about, how do I put it? Your battle with depression and your spiritual journey. Do you care? Can you share that with our listeners?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it's important for us once we cross a bridge to and we gain the power that comes from our pain. I truly believe in the power of sharing those testimonies because you just never know. You may be a bridge over troubled water for someone else. So I was a gifted kid. This goes back a little bit further. I was a gifted kid. My mother was a sharecropper. She did not know what to do with the kid like me. My mom had a seventh grade education from the 1940s, but she was really smart. And I'm a gifted kid who didn't have enough work to keep me occupied after school. By the time I was 15, I had lived a full life. My brother had a crack addiction. I will never forget that day. I remember in 1984 sitting on the couch in our little raggedy house on Cashin Street. And my brother's friend, he was an over-the-road truck driver, and he came back from California, and he called my brother to the door and said, "Man, you got to try this." And my brother stepped outside with my mother begging him don't go out that door. Just don't go out that door. My brother left and we didn't see him for about 2 weeks. And the truck that my our neighbor friend drove in on, it stayed behind our house until the trucking company actually came to collect it. They had crack for the first time that night, and it changed all of our lives in ways that it's just hard to explain. Yeah. So I was 7 years old, and from the time I was seven to the time I turned 15, I raised six kids. Essentially, my childhood ended at seven, and just talking about it sometimes, it's a little painful, but I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. So by the time I'm 15, I've raised six kids. I'm not really interested in things that my friends are doing because I've grown past that. Being that gifted kid who also came from a very low income community, we didn't have a lot of material things, a lot of money, but we had a lot of love. And that love is what encouraged my mother and grandmother to sacrifice my childhood to keep our family together. As a child, I didn't understand that. I thought it was torture. But by the time I was 15, I was interested in teenage things. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I ended up getting pregnant. Not only did I get pregnant, but I got pregnant by another 15-year-old young man who unfortunately had committed a drive-by shooting. And he had been arrested, but was on house arrest for a homicide. Mm-hmm. My 15-year-old brain did not comprehend that he's wearing this ankle bracelet for a reason and it meant something. No, my 15-year-old brain didn't comprehend that in idle time. And you know what they say about idle time. It is truly the devil's workshop. Take my word. So at 15, I became a new parent to my daughter, my one and only daughter. She's now 31 years old. Her father is still in prison. The state of Alabama made an example out of him. And as a result of my journey and the decisions that led me to that junction, life became even more difficult than I could have ever imagined. But I'm so grateful that I had a supportive family because in the same way that they used my life to support my nieces and nephews, they also stood in the gap for me. My mother quit her job as soon as I delivered my daughter. And my mom was old school. She told me, she said, "Tiffany, you're grown now. The well has run dry. So you got to go out here and do what grown people do. You need to provide for us." I did. But I was also required to stay in school and work two jobs to make ends meet. But I'm looking back, I'm so grateful for all of that because my daughter was truly a blessing to all of us. But in that moment, she became the biggest blessing and unspoken prayer that my mother had at that time. Yeah. Because my mom honestly got pregnant at 13, but with her first child, but she was never afforded the opportunity to sit still and be a mother and love on a child. So my daughter was that for her, but me, 15, I'm out here working like a grown woman. Yeah, depression finally caught up with me in the worst way. I was about 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And I did what I was supposed to do, went to the doctor, and they put me on a birth control pill that unfortunately had not been tested by the FDA, and it had too much estrogen in it. Or I should say the birth control had not been approved by the FDA. Mm-hmm. I was part of the test unknowingly. Mm-hmm. And it threw me off chemically. I didn't understand really how to communicate what I was experiencing. Did not have insurance. So I was going to a community clinic that was treating us on a slot fee basis. And I share that to say, I didn't have access to competitive health care. So I took what I had. And with that, they didn't take the best care of me and they didn't listen to my concerns. Instead of switching my birth control, I was given two different antidepressants, one to take in the morning and one to take at night. And when it devastated my life. Mm-hmm. My mother didn't understand the issues that I was trying to work through. They didn't understand mental health back then. They knew was to just put your big girl panties on and keep moving. But that mm-hmm. didn't work. I was breaking and dying on the inside. So this is crazy. I stayed in school the entire time. I was so focused on school. I was on the president's list one semester. The following semester, I was on the dean's list with A's and B's. And that third semester in that year, I made straight A's and one F. And that F was my breaking point. I was driving home from school one night, and I had already made my peace with God. I apologized to the professor for failing her class because I honestly lost my grip. It was statistics out of all things. I love numbers. Mm. And I left there feeling at the lowest of lows over an F on my report card. And I think that's just my high levels of self-excellence. But a part of me, that was the only thing that I had control of. So when I couldn't make those high marks, it crushed me. So as I'm leaving school that night, I'll never forget it. It was summer semester, a warm early August night in Alabama, and I'm driving towards the Tennessee River Bridge. And I was about to turn the wheel to, I knew this one little spot where I could miss the bridge and go in, and that's where I was headed. And I heard this little voice say, "Look up." And I looked up, and it was 7:30 at night, but it was 5 o'clock traffic out of nowhere. And I was so angry. I went home and I made it through that night. But when I got home, my mother was sitting there as if she had been anticipating me. And my daughter, my mom told my daughter, she said, "Come here, babe, let me hold you." And she looked at me and she said, "Tiffany, something's going on with you. I really don't understand. But I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I'm going to lose you. And I'm afraid that I might have to kill you. But I found some help. So we have somewhere to go tonight." And my people were very Southern, religious, church-going people. And we grew up in a non-denominational spiritual church, fivefold. My mom took me way back in the country, somewhere I had never gone, to this pastor, this man of God. And I didn't believe in, even though I grew up in church, in a church where we had prophets and we believed in the healing power of God, at that low moment, I didn't believe in him. And my mom sent me in by myself, and she gave me a $40 donation. And she said, "Tiffany, get us the man of God and tell him it's a blessing for him. It's a love offering." And when I walked in the house, I'm thinking, why did she give him this money? Like, I had just quit my job because I was ready to end my life. And I said, "I need this." And when I went in, man of God said, "Tell your mama to, she can keep that $40. Someone already blessed me today." And I was like, that was strange. And then he said, "Tiffany, why were you going to drive into that river? You know you can't swim." And nobody knew that. And I said, okay, he has my attention. So that was the first round with the depression. But he gave me specific instructions from God. And I listened and did everything that he said. And I went home. And after that, I slept on it. I went back to school, and I met my first therapist in secret because I knew that I could get those free resources. And she was a Black woman, and she handled me very delicately and quietly. To this day, my family still did not know that I sought out therapy in addition to hearing the word from God. But those two encounters, and also my daughter was 5 years old, and she did not realize her coming into my room that morning, sitting in the dark with her little legs crossed. And she said, "Mom, don't die. I need you." And I said, what makes you think I'm going to die?" And she said, "Mom's too old to take care of me, Mom. Please don't die." And I said, "Okay, baby, I'm fine. But I will tell you, that was the turning point for me. However, it really took about 7 years for me to really find myself and become whole again. But that's my journey with depression and suicide and finding freedom from it.
Wow. What a compelling story. First, thank you so much for the transparency and for sharing that. I know that our listeners will get a lot out of it. And even I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. You know, I hear a number of things. Women of color being underserved by the medical profession. Well, you even talked about the crack epidemic. And for those who didn't live during that era, I can only tell you what you see on TV doesn't even compare to the impact it had on America as a whole, but specifically on our community. And then the divine intervention piece. We definitely have to talk about the suicide. And I mentioned in the beginning that there is an overlap here. And we asked Dr. Livingston, and by the way, it was Tiffany's idea. So kudos to you for really throwing that out there. There's so much he can. We would do you all a disservice if we didn't try to, number one, educate people on the risk of suicide, suicide prevention, and number two, just really share these experiences, because I think suicide has impacted us all in some form or fashion. I've lost a friend through suicide. I've lost a relative who loved dearly by suicide. So without further, I want Dr. Livingston, I want to ask you, is there anything, I kind of gave everyone some of your background. Is there something else you want to share or even tell your story before I start asking you questions about this important topic?
Well, I wanted to reflect on Tiffany's story. I really didn't realize how similar our backgrounds, you know, were. I come from a low income area, and being low income kid and gifted is unique. We actually published an article on it about 15 years ago, and that most folks don't know how isolating that experience is.
Yeah.
I think you know. And the challenges you face as a low income kid when you're in classes with individuals from upper incomes who don't look like you, teachers who are surprised that you're there, and students who are surprised that you're there. And you may not have a peer support network that's supported. So that's a whole nother topic. But it was really interesting hearing that story. And moreover, what you talked about in terms of the impact, the structural, psychological, individual impact of crack cocaine on our community, it's something that we really, as researchers, as mental health professionals, we dealt with it, but we hadn't even had time to process it.
That's right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that itself is a unique reflective study. What happened to our community? You know, things fell apart, essentially. Now, in terms of anything I wanted to share, North Carolina Central, I just wanted to indicate that we were nominated top psychology, HBCU top psychology program in the country. In 2024, we have over 500 students, a master's program with a clinical and general program, and we have an online program. Many of our students go on to the top PhD programs in the country. So if there's anything unique I want to share, is that ego excellence. That's what I wanted to share.
Thank you so much. And wow, this I'm so grateful for both of you, because I know that there's value in this discussion. And I know, I'm praying that if someone is considering or contemplating or have suicidal ideations, that they will listen to some of the things that you're going to share and say, hey, I need to get help. But I'll just start with you, Dr. Livingston, on this, those warning signs. I think it's important for us as husband, wives, parents, our friends. What are the warning signs, or can you help us with that?
Yeah, one of the obvious is them talking about suicide, talking about death,
yeah,
making threats. Depression is always there. And with depression, for some, there may be suicide ideation, but there's a preoccupation with death. You know, their social media posts, looking at what they're posting, artwork, it may be reflective in their artwork. If they engage in any kind of planning where they are talking about steps, that's a warning sign.
Yeah.
Moreover, increased rates of alcohol and drugs, and that substance use, some young people and older people use it to cope. Some psychologists suggest that African Americans have been self-medicating for years because of the reluctance to seek mental health services, and that they may be self-medicating through alcohol and other substances. Other warning signs, that feelings of hopelessness. You know, they feel worthless, and you see it reflective in how they describe themselves. It's being overwhelmed with guilt. These all can impact suicide ideation. So those are some key signs that they're talking about it. If you see them depressed, they begin to isolate, lack of interest in other things, a decline in performance in school, they're irritable. If they're preoccupied with death, you know, watching their posts, if they're talking about it, if you see it in their artwork, if they begin to plan, if you see increased consumption of alcohol and drug use to cope with problems, as well as these feelings of hopelessness and worthlessness.
That's good info right there. You made me think about something else. Tiffany touched on it, those stigmas. There's always, well, she mentioned therapy, so we already know the stigma with in our community as far as therapy, but also suicide, because I remember growing up, I think y'all will concur, Black people don't commit suicide. You used to hear things like that. Do you think we're in a better place than we were, say, 10 years ago as it relates to suicide awareness?
I think we're in a much better place, given the advertisements, given the, you know, athletes who come out, given the people, high profile people who come out and begin to talk about mental illness and mental health and wellness. So I think we're in a much better place. People are more amenable to talking about their feelings. With African Americans in particular, historically, we were told to rely on the church, take it to the altar. And there is a need for some healing between the faith community and the African-American community, in particular among the young people,
yes,
in that I don't see a schism between faith and healing. I don't see a schism between faith and psychology, in that many people go to the altar for therapeutic reasons. Many people engage in shouting and go into a trance-like state and speak in tongues, and it's therapeutic for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that relationship with the faith community, church, where young people begin to understand that going to church, that fellowship, that therapeutic community that the faith community creates, getting advice from older people who've been through what you've been through, it's all right there in the church. So I think that it is less stigma. I think we are more amenable to mental health, but it's still a piece where we need to heal that relationship with the faith-based community. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And so we talked about the stigma. Any other myths or misconceptions about suicide that you can think of? I just want to make certain we cover all the bases.
There's some misconceptions that some folks have that talking about suicide will make a person suicidal. It doesn't. Or that another misconception that people who talk about suicide are just seeking attention. Yeah. And they may be seeking attention, but it's good to listen to them. Another one is that it happens without warnings. Many times there are signs that we see it. When we reflect back upon it, we see the isolation. We see the change of job. We see the constant moving. We see that there's something going on there. Moreover, this misconception that folks have that only people with mental health problems consider suicide. Understand clearly, there's some high-profile people who, on the outside.
This episode is brought to you by Kingdom Harvest Church, helping people discover, develop, demonstrate, and duplicate God's love as disciple-making leaders. Visit their webpage at www.khcnc.org.
And on there. Moreover, this misconception that folks have that only people with mental health problems consider suicide. Understand clearly, there's some high-profile people who, on the outside, have everything going on. They have money, they have success, and they've committed suicide. The other misconception that, you know, these thoughts, these suicide ideation, it never goes away. That's untrue. Through rational motive therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, various medications, individuals, these thoughts go away. And number six, that is not preventable. Suicide is definitely preventable. That being able to sit down, listen to people, taking people seriously, validating their experiences. Okay?
Yeah.
Another one we have with young people, you know, two in particular, in that young people, you know, either young people cannot be suicidal, you know, we can't, you know, you shouldn't take them seriously. What do they have to worry about? They don't have a mortgage and jobs, but they can be suicidal. And that emotionally, their brain has not developed and they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. Last but not least is the assumption that young people are more likely or have higher rates of suicide than others. And that's not true. You find that suicide is higher among older age individuals. So those are a few of them, you know, that they don't go away, that only people with mental health issues commit suicide. And so this is just a few of the common misconceptions.
Those are nuggets. I really appreciate that. There's so much value in what you just shared. So we talked about the misconceptions, the signs of suicide. What steps do we take? How do we address if someone we know has talked about suicide? How do we support those who are at risk?
And that's key. Number one, encouraging them to contact loved ones. COVID isolated us. We didn't see folks. You know, even when folks passed, folks didn't get to see each other. So really reconnecting with loved ones. You know, I love the family reunions and people reconnecting post-COVID because I knew it would provide a therapeutic space for some of the young people.
Yes.
Being able to express your feelings, encouraging people to express their feelings. Writing it down. Sometimes just write it. Even if you don't send it to somebody, just writing down how you feel. Or just talking to yourself and talking it out. Checking in. Just checking in sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Just checking in. You know, and letting people know, you know, look, I'm going through something right now. And I need someone to talk to. You know, I am fortunate. I work in a psychology department, chairman of the psychology department. So I can... in that space with clinical psychologists say, hey, look, I'm struggling with something. I need some help. You know, Dr. Clyette, who's a clinical psychologist, tree just fell. He knows that my therapy is cutting trees. So if he sees me stressed, you know, I got this tree over here. You know, so just checking in with people, you know, having a supportive group. As we get older, having a really good group cohort of friends around us that call us on our stuff, that we can run stuff by, and that we can feel vulnerable around is critically important for our mental health.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. You know what really, I'm going back to what Tiffany was talking about with her experience and the impact of making an F on a, you know, in this class. And so my mind, when she was saying that, I immediately went to, at that age, you know, things like that seem so significant. I know that there were other things going on, but at that age, an F is, for lack of better words, like the end of the world. And then, you know, if you look at it now, like people in our age group, we look back and say, hey, it's an elf. There's so much more ahead of you, right? There's so many things. There are going to be peaks and valleys. Buku of peaks and valleys from now and into the rest of your life. So what are the, it makes me think about the uniqueness of risk factors for youth and teens. So is there something set aside from everyone else when you think about teens and youth as far as risk factors?
Yeah, common risk factors. Number one, if they have attempted before, okay? If they have attempted before, we know that there's some differences across gender and that men, their attempts usually end with injury. With females, those early attempts may be a cry for help. Mm-hmm. So previous attempts, them talking about it. Depression, okay? If you see long-term depression that increase alcohol and drug use, and again, many young people, and not just African-Americans, they cope with drugs and alcohol. We also find that, you know, previous conduct disorder and behavioral factors, getting in trouble in school, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder.
Hmm.
These shifts in, you know, family structure and family background, the economic shifts, the constant moving. You know, I always tell students when they're working with kids, go to the school records, look at the address. Are they moving a lot? If they were grandma the first part of the year, Aunt Pam, middle of the year, and now mom and them stable, you're going to see some fluctuations in the grade. Yeah. But there's an unsupportive family background, okay? And I loved what Tiffany, you said in that, you know, your parents, and like my parents, they were one, two generations from slavery. They didn't know how to be. All they knew is that, okay, I want you to do well. But they really didn't know how to support a gifted kid who was thinking about wormholes and time travel. other issues, relationship conflicts. And I've seen that over the years that we assume that in adolescence, it's just puppy love. But you will find that these emotionally charged relationships can lead them to some serious depression and they make some bad decisions.
Yeah.
Social and cultural factors, okay, are other factors, you know, and that adjusting to a new culture, moving to a new school, being in spaces where they feel like they're on the outside looking in. Does the kid have good coping skills?
Mm.
Okay. Can they cope with a stressor? Can they cope with a bad grade? I was feeling you on that, Tiff. Now, my grandkids will tell you now, I made a C one time, and I still tell me about my rubric for giving the money. You get 24 A, you get 10 for a B, and you owe me 5 for a C. Mm-hmm. And that's because of my trauma. I think my kids ever see that teacher gave them a C, they're going to have some words. And other factors is previous psychiatric issues. You know, with the current administration, even though we have some challenges, this focus on these current health and mental health challenges is a real issue. And that COVID impact, it did something to people. And I think these underlying psychiatric issues are beginning to manifest themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think these are all things that we need to consider when we begin to talk about, you know, common risk factors.
Mm. Wow, that's, man, I'm telling you, I really appreciate you, both of you. There's so much value in everything you said. Now let's talk about the schools, because I'm immediately thinking about social media and young people and how that can influence. And maybe I'm off. I'm not an expert like yourself. Is there any research supporting the impact of social media on suicide? And And then after that, I'll ask, what role should parents and teachers play in early detection and intervention?
There's abundance of evidence, and there are legal battles now over the impact of social media on young people. We underestimated it. We really did, because we don't use it. Just getting through our email on a day-to-day basis is tough enough. But they spend a considerable amount of time on it. They develop a reflection of who they are, who they're not, how they're valued off of a space that we can't even process. Mm-hmm. So what can, you know, schools are making some moves, moving the phones. Parents are limiting the amount of hours on that phone. I think parents need to monitor that phone and see how many hours are spent on social media. Yeah. Over letting them know that that's not reality. it's not reality. These are people putting up their perceptions of what they think you want to think of them. Now, what can the schools do to reduce these suicides? You know, how can they take action? Number one, create a culture where they promote the importance of emotional well-being and connectedness among students. The mental health days that some schools are doing. Hiring more mental health professionals in the schools, more school psychologists that do more than just testing.
Yeah.
Having events where you talk about emotions, you talk about issues. Being able to identify students who may be at risk, okay? Those risk factors we talked about earlier, disruptive behavior, family instability, be on the lookout for it. And moreover, be able to respond as a school with counselors, teachers, principals, all working together when a suicide occurs. Because what we have found is that when one occurs, we begin to see these patterns. Moreover, even if students don't attempt, they begin to become depressed. So we need to have a team, a response team, every time it happens. And providing a space where they can talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Thank you. Man, I appreciate all this. Before we go, I want to go back to Tiffany a little bit. But before I do, I want to make certain, is there anything you want to close with on the suicide prevention piece of all of this? That I miss, a question I didn't ask, or something you say, hey, there's an emphasis on this, let me share this.
This question's for me?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Yes. You want to share, anything that I left out on suicide prevention you want to add before I go to Tiffany?
I wanted to talk about what parents can do. Actually, right before I left, I was with two brothers that I know personally who their children are not here anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was the first time we were able to talk about it after years.
Yeah.
And I think forming a good relationship with our children is critically important as a preventive effort. Now, what that means is providing a safe and stable environment in the home. That we can talk, that everybody ain't got to walk around on eggshells, that you can actually come to me. I know you're 8, you're 6, you're 13, 14, 15, our relationship done changed, and, you know, you're becoming your own person, but you got to understand, I'm your friend, too. I'm not just your father. I'm your encourager. I'm your supporter. I'm your friend. I'm your advocate.
Yeah.
And spending quality time, okay? You will be surprised how many kids over the years I've heard say this. And it was hard for me because I'll be honest, I didn't want to be around my parents because I didn't like them. I didn't want to be around them because they're going to make me do some work. Move that wood over there, you know, the wood already been moved there. It's summertime. Why are we moving wood? idle hands is the devil player. Go pick up these cigarette butts throughout this neighborhood. Why am I don't even smoke. Neighborhood that God, cleanliness is next to godliness. You know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So, but spending quality time, you know, many kids now want to spend quality time with their parents. Yes. And that they enjoy actually being with their parents. And parents have to provide that space, even if it's going to a movie, playing putt-putt golf, going out to dinner, and more with an active listening, okay? Not only what's being said, but what's not being said. Does that make sense? Looking at their eye movement, looking at, you know, the intentions. What are they really saying to you? And also being supportive, but not intrusive.
Yes.
I'm going to support your decisions. I'm not going to be too intrusive because, now, you know, now you're a teenager. You want your space, you know, even though it's my house, but in real life, with your space, but not being too intrusive. And that's a balance. And last but not least, encouraging appropriate expressions and emotions, in particular among young males. You know, these young males are told, you know, boys aren't supposed to cry. Or if you're a young girl, you know, you ain't supposed to talk in certain settings. It's imperative that we let them voice their opinion, because if not, it'll come out in a disruptive or explosive manner. We got to teach them the skills of being able to express their feelings, to be able to negotiate, to be able to listen. Mm-hmm. So that emotional expression piece and having a space at home and teaching them how to do it is critically important. And that's all.
I would like to touch on what you just said. My mother, like, I was raised to be very strong because I had to be responsible very early in life. So I took on the habits of my family. We didn't talk about our problems. We just kept going, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing I'm very grateful for was my mother watching me and observing the changes that I was going through. And I'm so grateful for that night that she intervened. But I would like to express, you know, as a parent, I would like to encourage other parents, start talking about those changes the moment that you notice them, because my mother was almost a day late.
Thank you for sharing that. Anything else to add on the suicide piece of this?
Well, I would like to just share this. I was on a class or a training today, and it really was still disheartening to hear that African Americans the suicide rate is still growing in our population, and we lead the population in suicidal deaths. We still have a lot of work to do. And I believe personally, based on the work that I do with my nonprofit organization, I believe access issues are probably the number one problem with Black people talking about their problems and being supported with their mental health. And also, too, the stigma still exists today, and there's still work that needs to be done in breaking down those barriers. I shared with you all about my brother having a crack addiction, and as an adult, it took me to just assess him and observe him. And because no one talks about their problems, it took me to become an adult and forgive him for all the pain that I had to live through because of his addiction. But I realized late in life that my brother was his inner child was still wounded. And the crack addiction, which he still struggles with 40 years later, is a result of that inner child being wounded.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you reminded me, because I think, and Dr. Livingston touched on it too, I think every, and especially in our community, we all have that relative, that uncle or cousin, in your case, a brother, someone who suffered from crack addiction back then. And we all remember the impact. It was not just traumatizing for them and their experience, but for us, because, you know, we put up with, or we suffered through it with them, meaning that they continuously victimized us, whether they're stealing something from us or borrowing money, never giving it back, just doing all kind, or we're visiting them in jail, or we isolated them and cut them off completely. And so we're traumatized through their addiction as well. I love the fact that Dr. Livingston mentioned that, because it is so true. And what you just shared about what you went through, that I'm telling you, if you didn't grow up or know about it or live through that era, thank God that that people aren't going through it or living through it now, because there's no way to describe it. You had to be there. And I remember as a beat cop, just a mother calling us because her husband took the game, their children's video game, and he sold it for a rock. And the kids are crying. She's asking us to do something. And we had to look her in the face and say, there's nothing we can do, because that's his house. That's his property. He can do, you know, what. And you're basically standing there as a young officer saying, I can't help these kids. And so everyone's suffering through that. So I don't think we'll ever fully understand how horrific that impact was, right? What do y'all think?
It was devastating. You saw overnight bars up to window. Working class and middle class people left many of the black communities. It split our community. Yeah. Moreover, property values went down.
Yeah.
Okay? Now you done seen them go back up, but they had gone down. So the black middle class left many of the black neighborhoods in Charlotte, Durham, New York, D.C., everywhere. Yeah. And so that structural impact, the economic impact, also was a factor. And we're seeing, you know, those neighborhoods become gentrified now.
Yeah.
You're seeing those political structures with a political power in those black neighborhoods, because you had a black middle class, a black working class in that neighborhood. That neighborhood had a voice at city council. That's gone now.
Yeah.
I mean, and so there are number of impacts of there are impacts at a number of levels here that we really need to take a look at. We really do.
So you just said something I just want to touch on briefly. For the most of my career, I worked in gentrification. And honestly, that's the reason I walked away. One day I just woke up and I made the connection and I said, I can't do this anymore.
Wow.
It was a career that you had to grow in. It's not something that you can go to school for. And I reached a point in my career when, throughout my career, I'm asking, what happens to the people when we gentrify these communities, right? Well, I make it so far in my career, and this one company I worked for, they gave us like a bio or a speech about the founder. And what I learned in that at that orientation was, oh, he signed the tax credit deal with Bob Dole in 1984. And no joke, about 2 years later, I'm going about my happy day driving back from Albany, Georgia, from a site visit, right? And it clicked, 1984, what was going on in my life? Oh my God, the crack addiction, the crack epidemic in America. So as crack was devastating our community, laws were being created to gentrify our communities. That was what, 41 years ago. Now that those guidelines are really still having an impact in our communities from 41 years ago.
Yeah, I entertained it in the 1990s as I began to see the working class and middle class blacks move to other sides of town. And I began to see things in those neighborhoods, you know, the selling, the trafficking, the neighborhoods that were working class, middle class black neighborhoods. I began to see them go down, and I began to wonder whether or not it was intentional. And that was 34 years ago. Is this intentional?
Well, see, I don't think it was honestly intentional at the time. I really honestly at the time, because it started in 1984. I don't think they understood the ramifications that would come from that just like the destruction of our mental health funding that took place in the 80s. Because now, I mean, back in those days, we had mental health institutes and hospitals that employed a lot of people from where I lived. And by 1990, they were all gone.
Wow, this is very popular. That, hey, you know what? That's a whole nother episode we have to do then, right? This is some good stuff, some good information and experiences. I was going to ask you, Tiffany, I think you touched on it, what made you transition from that world of academia and things that you, it looked like a path was pretty, you had a straight line path to go into the sciences, and you deviated from that, and you really, public service seems to be the hat that you're wearing. What transitioned you from that to grace?
Well, it was always, I believe the work that I'm doing now is the work that I was actually created to do. Because I am a scientist and I always try to think of things logically, my life had to make sense, and it didn't make sense for a very long time. I would just go wherever God placed me. And initially coming out of college, I thought that I would work for NASA. I had an opportunity to go to Houston. I was being recruited right there in the classroom, and my mother wouldn't go with me. So when my former director called me and asked me to come to the King Center temporarily, I jumped to the bit. Then after working at the Martin Luther King Center for approximately 20 months, we lost our funding on the grant that I was hired through. And my career took a change. So I ended up working for SunTrust Mortgage, and I love SunTrust. Oh my goodness, it was an amazing place to work. I learned so much. There were so many different directions to go in. Well, guess what? The recession happened, and we folded. My department was first to go. I worked in construction with that company also. So I end up at the state working in low-income housing tax credit development, not knowing what all it entailed, but I had a skill set that they needed. Everything that was on my resume up to that date was required for them to create this new role. So I was the needle in the haystack. And once I came into that position, because I get bored so quickly, I loved it. It was so much information to take on, so many projects, a lot of paperwork, long hours. I absolutely loved it. And I grew in a few directions. Up until that screeching halt, when I walked away from my career, there was no plan for me to walk away from my career. I just woke up and said, I cannot do this another day. I prayed about it and I said, Lord, I'm probably going to make a big mistake, but I'm about to take a leap and you're going to have to catch me. And God allowed me 2 years to allow my neuro system to rest. And that was important for me because something I didn't share through that last 5 years of, well, let's see, my mother had a stroke in 2013, and my mom and I always had a pact, or honestly, I gave God a yes, another yes. And you have to be careful when you give God a yes. Around that time, after I came out of the depression, man of God called me one day and said, Tiffany, God said, you're going to have to take care of your mother one day. Will you be good to her? And I said, yes, I will. Well, I didn't think anything of it. I'm 21. And I also took care of my grandma. And on my grandmother's deathbed, the last question she asked me was, Dorothy's going to need you. Would you take care of her? I said, yes, ma'am, I will. And she said, God is pleased. And so I gave God a yes, right? So when mother got sick, I became a consultant. And during that time, I started, as I'm sitting at the hospital with nothing to do for 3.5 years, in and out of the hospital, I started writing out the vision, like what would inspire me? What would just make me happy at this point in my life? And I put the vision away, right? Fast forward about 4 years later, after I was in a new season of life and I am sitting still on a hiatus and allowing my neuro system to relax, I spent a lot of time with God and I did a lot of soul seeking. And I told him, I said, Lord, my life, it doesn't make sense because it belongs to you. What will you have me to do in this upcoming season? During that time, as I applied for the 501c3 and continued to build, unfortunately, my cousin, who I grew up with as brother and sister cousin, he committed suicide. And I said, you know what? Instead of working with teenage single mothers who share my life story, I believe God is calling me to do something.
This episode is brought to you by Manna Ministries. Manna Ministries, an initiative that focuses on extending our reach beyond the walls of our church to touch the lives of those in our community and beyond. So let me say this. This initiative aims to share the message of Christ's love through various forms of outreach, addressing both spiritual and practical needs, right? Focusing on providing essential services that enhance the well-being of individuals and families, and reflecting the servant heart of Jesus Christ. Visit us at mannaministries704.org. Manna Ministries.
I believe God is calling me to do something deeper. And get to the root of the problem, because that's what scientists do, right? Rocket scientists, we get to the root of the problem.
Yes.
And I decided, you know, I'm going to work with teens, because if I had the support that I needed as a teenager, my daughter's life would be a lot different. And I gave God another yes one night, spending the night with my daughter. He woke me up and asked me, or told me, it's time to sell the house. And I said, yes, sir. And I woke up the next day, went home. I didn't tell my daughter a thing. Stopped at Walmart, and I filled my trunk and my backseat up with moving supplies. And I went home, and I started packing my house. And about the third day, I finally called my daughter after like half of my house it was packed. And I asked her, I said, would you happen to know a realtor? And she told me, and she said, who's moving, Mom? I might be able to get a bonus. And I said, me. She was like, where are you going? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know. Don't ask me no questions. I'll let you know when I figure it out. And that's how I ended up where I am today. Wow. God led me here. I didn't know I was coming to North Carolina. I thought I was headed to the beach. I had my heart set on moving to the beach, restarting my consulting business, getting back into housing. And after a series of following new instructions that came, see, that's why you have to have a personal relationship with God. Because when he speaks, yes, it's usually in a very quiet, still voice. And yes. After following a few instructions that were given, I landed in North Carolina. I was not in Durham. I was in Garner, actually. And when I landed in Garner and staying with relatives, I continued to work on the nonprofit. I did not know the full plan. But what happened was I was helping a sister in Christ build her online ministry. And we were teaching other women how to obey the Holy Spirit and how to walk in authority and operate in the Holy Spirit. And the one night that we opened up and told everybody, show us what God has given you, this lady spoke a word in my life and told me, Tiffany, she was from California, never seen her, never spoke with her again. And she said, God just showed me a vision of you with a very formal dress on and a very formal head wrap on, and you're spinning around. And as you spin, I see glitter. It looks like glitter falling off of your dress, but I also see you being surrounded by a lot of kids. She said, what I interpret that to be is those are your gifts that you're sharing with other kids. And I said, well, glory to God. Okay. And that solidified to me, I am where I'm supposed to be, right? Yeah, that's how I landed here. And I will tell you this, after finding that first office space, that was an act of God, because I initially was headed to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I drove there. And when I parked my car and I said, I don't know where God's going. He hasn't given me any instructions. So I thought I was going to force the hand of God, right? And yeah. I get out in Fayetteville and I feel this void, and that void was the same feeling that I felt back in Atlanta. I was like, I don't belong here, right? Mm-hmm. And I go to Raleigh and I felt the same emptiness that I did in Fayetteville. And I was driving around in the rain that day, and I got out of the car and I'm standing in the rain crying. I'll never forget it. And my cousin called me and said, she asked me, why are you crying? And I told her. She Googled two places and sent them to me and said, here, go find a new office. So I land in Durham, right? I get here and God led me to a church one Sunday, and I go to that church. And the lady who directed me there, I met her at the bank, and she said, I believe that my dad is supposed to help you. Here's his information. I go to the church, and as I'm sitting in church listening to the sermon, I realized that man of God was preaching to me. Mm-hmm. He was talking about how sometimes in life God will send you on a journey, and those journeys have to be traveled alone. But he'll give you everything that you need, but you have to be obedient. And I was like, oh, dear God. I felt so convicted, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And as I'm sitting there, I hear the Spirit of God say, Recreation Center, a couple of times. And I said, okay. So after church, I approached the pastor, and I shared with him how his sermon was just for me, I believe. But I asked him, I said, Pastor Couch, I keep hearing the Spirit of God say recreation centers. I feel like I'm supposed to be somewhere in this area. He said, go down to the corner, turn left on the first street, and you go see the rec center right there on your left. I was in walking distance of the rec center. And when I pulled up, I totally understood the assignment, because in my career, I would go into communities like Cornwallis and erase them with developers under the mighty guise of gentrification. And it was intersectionality of my life's purpose coming into full fruition. So the intersection of my everything that troubled me as a child and everything that I grew out of, in addition to my career. And yeah, that's how I've landed in Durham, and Grace took off.
That is a great story. I appreciate you sharing it, man. And I appreciate you being obedient, because without obedience, we wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be running Grace, and you wouldn't really be, I guess, stepping in your purpose, right? Reaching full actualization. So God bless you. Thank you.
Glory to God.
Yeah. And we really, I would love for us to continue this again, because this is just such a great discussion we're having. We're over the hour mark. It's good stuff. I think it's so much more that our listeners could benefit from both of you. But as we start wrapping up, I want to ask you, both of you, if you have anything you want to share before we close out. It could be about what you're doing now. It could be about your vision and your respective fields. It could be more on suicide or on the crack epidemic. So I will. I'll start with you, Dr. Livingston. Any final thoughts?
You know, I was. I'm probably not the kind of person to ask what you think because I can go from JFK to Dr. Biggie.
But it's all connected. Boring,
they're gonna be on the chest, but it's all connected.
It's never boring, though.
I think the biggest thing I want young people to take home is this. And I asked a group of friends of mine who were around and were young during the 1960s. And I asked them this question after Malcolm, after Martin, after what they saw with Kennedy, both Kennedys. Have y'all healed? Hmm. And I think young people need to understand they are going through one of the most unique times in human history. Okay. Yes. And for them to feel sad, anxious, mad, that's normal. They should be. Mm-hmm. They should be. This is, they've gone through since 2000, Y2K, 9/11, stock market crash, Gen 6, turmoil with the economy, turmoil on the street, George Floyd. Over and over again, psychologically, they have been hit. So for them to feel anxious, for them to feel depressed, it's natural. And they have to understand, you know, we have to encourage them not only express these feelings, but let them know, just like the common cold, this too shall pass. You got plenty of other battles to deal with.
Yes.
And that's what you got to tell them. This is you live in a unique time. You live in a difficult time, similar to the times individuals spent in the late 50s, 60s. Your experience. We know you're confused. We know you feel uncertain. We know sometimes you feel hopeless. But we're here to listen to you and help you through this. That's really what I wanted to say to young people.
Thank you so much. Tiffany.
So I will say this. When your life is created for purpose, it's not going to be linear. It's going to be tough, but you just have to continue to trust God and be obedient to his plan. It'll make sense in the end. And I just encourage anyone out there, when you give God a yes, also be prepared for the test to come, because sometimes, as they say in the Bible, the ship might wreck. But you won't be wrecked, especially when God has purpose over your life. So I hope that my story has empowered someone, because I will say this, I'm very proud of myself for being able to alchemize my pain into purpose, but that would have been impossible without a strong support system. So I encourage everyone, if you don't have a strong support system, get you a good therapist and choose your friends wisely.
I'm so glad you mentioned therapy, because that, to me, that's the centerpiece of it. And I'm going to go back to what Dr. Livingston said earlier, because I think all too often we think it's either church or therapy. It's not exclusive. You can have both. And so thank you for sharing that. I appreciate both of you more than you know. I hope y'all will come back. Open door invitation anytime you want to come on. God bless you both, and I will see you soon.
Thank you, Chief
James. Don't forget to follow the Unknown Preacher LA podcast. We're on all podcast platforms.
It's the unknown, unknown. It's the unknown, unknown preacher. It's the unknown preacher. Unknown preacher. Unknown preacher. Unknown preacher. Unknown preacher. Tell me what we talk about.
the unknown.